And you're hearing the music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And I am sitting at the table with, as always, the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Linda.
Woohoo! It's an exciting, I would say, happy winter-themed hello from everyone, because we are all so incredibly excited to be here.
An icy blast of good cheer.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it's so incredibly cold.
It is. It's quite cold outside. Now, of course, everyone I know back in Minnesota is currently doing the typical "I can't believe you bunch of sissies" thing, and they're not wrong.
Didn't they do that already?
They did.
When I lived in Wisconsin, I constantly thought everyone was a great big pansy.
Yes, me too.
Every day is little match girl cold in the Midwest.
Can you two tell us what it sounds like when people from Minnesota and Wisconsin mock us for our cold wussiness?
Oh gosh, I don't know. You know, you guys, you talk about a cold day here. I've seen Brett Favre take the field. No, gotta get the Brett Favre references
no,
up front.
I don't know. I know that you guys try really hard, but you just don't necessarily have it in you. You know, we have a whole different thing going on out there. We're very hard-nosed.
All right, I can't take it anymore.
We're very hard-nosed about the weather.
Linda lived in Minnesota, and I lived in Wisconsin. And every time I do a Wisconsin accent, it always just goes back to Brett Favre. Mm. Every time Linda does a Minnesota accent, it goes back to just the most cheerful passive aggressiveness imaginable.
Well, that's because when I originally picked up my Minnesota accent, I was working in customer service on the telephone.
Oh, God.
And I discovered that a lot of things, they go down a lot easier if you say, "Oh, I totally understand why you're so frustrated, but there's just not a whole lot I can do for you. I gotta tell you, it's just, unfortunately, I know, but unless you got a copy of the paperwork, you're just gonna have to send it in again. We'll do everything we can. I'm real sorry." Anyway, so now that we've tried out our various accents, Stephen, why don't you tell the nice people who you are?
I am Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
And Wisconsin.
And a Wisconsin
transplant.
Quasi-native.
Yeah. How about you, Trey?
I'm Trey Graham. I edit the movies coverage at NPR.org, and I work behind Linda on the Monkey See blog, and I'm from the Deep South.
Yes, you are. How about you, Glenn Weldon?
Glenn Weldon. I write about books and comic books for the NPR website, Pennsylvania.
How come
nothing exciting, nothing sexy about Pennsylvania?
Yeah, well.
How come Trey Graham's Deep South accent never really comes out?
Yeah. It comes out when I have a little too much bourbon and if I talk to my mama on the phone.
How come that has never happened during our... Not that you need to talk to your mother on the phone during our podcast, but how come you have never had enough bourbon during our podcast?
Well, as we like to say at Pop Culture Happy Hour, the happy hour is merely virtual until the moment we stop recording.
That's true.
That's true.
After which it becomes quite real. Anyway, so it is that time of year, the most wonderful time of the year, as they say.
It is.
It is the time when I begin to be fearful once again of Babes in Toyland. And it is the time of year when pop culture, too, turns its flowery attentions to the season at hand. To Christmas, to the end of the year, to the snow, to the man in the red hat. So we thought that we would talk a little bit about our favorite and least favorite holiday pop culture artifacts, items, and so
objects.
Forth. Objects. So why don't we start? Can I go around and start with you, Glenn Weldon, and give us a favorite?
Sure. I'm going to start with The Year Without a Santa Claus.
Woohoo!
The Rankin-Bass animated, stop-motion animated masterpiece, more popularly known as The One with Snow Miser and Heat Miser.
That's right.
And I'm just going to make a point here. Snow Miser, people. Not Cold Miser. Not Mr. Cold Miser. Man's name is Snow Miser. It has become a beloved holiday classic, basically on the back of two songs. It's not the story, as I'll touch on in a second. It's these two songs, the song that Snow Miser, played by the veteran character actor Dick Shawn, sings.
I'm Mr. White Christmas. I'm Mr. Snow. I'm Mr. Icicle. I'm Mr. Ten Below. Friends call me Snow Miser. Whatever I touch turns to snow in my clutch. I'm too much.
And the variation of that same song that is sung by Broadway veteran playing a Heat Miser, George S. Irving. And if you think you don't know who George S. Irving is or what he looks like, you do, because the animators have modeled Heat Miser so closely on George S. Irving that it's a little unsettling.
I'm Mr. Green Christmas. I'm Mr. Sun. I'm Mr. Heat Blister. I'm Mr. 101. They call me Heat Miser. Whatever I touch starts to melt in my I'm too much.
So, the two songs you will hear a lot this time of year, because inevitably you're going to be going to some kind of holiday-themed party, and some wag will bust out the song, and they will inevitably screw up the lyrics horribly. And if you are me, this really upsets you, this really fires up your nerd rage. I was at an event not too long ago, and a gentleman started to bust it out, and here's what I do with my feckless nerd rage. I chronicle it. Typed it into my phone. Mm-hmm. So, Linda, you want to see the title of the memo that I wrote to myself?
There was a memo? I was thinking there was a tweet.
He wrote a memo with the title, Party Doofus.
Party Doofus. Take that guy I'll never see again. Here's what he said. I wrote it down. He says, that one with Mr. Heat Miser and Mr. Cold Miser. And then he started to sing, I'm Mr. Cold Miser, I'm Mr. Ten Below. Now, where to even begin?
Good Lord.
First of all, your scansions all to hell. Your dactyls and your spondies are messing each other up. Trust me, I would get this guy not getting the words right if he were trying to sing the entire song. Mm-hmm. I'll give him a pass. I would get him not getting the words right if it was 1983, right, and it was only... It was on once a year.
Maybe you saw it that year, maybe you didn't.
Exactly. We live, however, in the age of the internet. This is all over the place, so... just for your records, clip and save for your records. Here it is. I'm Mr. White Christmas. People always get this wrong because people forget that it's a Christmas song. I'm Mr. White Christmas. I'm Mr. Snow. I'm Mr. Icicle. I'm Mr. Ten Below. And then friends call me Snow Miser. Snow Miser. Whatever I touch turns to snow. My clutch. I'm too much. And there's a bridge. I never want to. Exactly. It is a jaunty tune.
Yeah.
Not saying it's not. The bridge is.
I'm just helping.
I appreciate that. I never want to see a day that's over 40 degrees. I'd rather have it 30, 20, 10, 5, and let it freeze. That's the song, people. There's not much to it. And the Heat Miser version is very similar. I'm Mr. Green Christmas. Because, again, remember, Christmas, green. I'm Mr. Green Christmas. I'm Mr. Sun. I'm Mr. Heat Blister. Therefore, we get a little violent imagery into the song, therefore demarcating their two personality types. I'm Mr. 101. They call me Heat Miser. What does that tell you?
He has no friends.
He has no friends.
Yep.
That's exactly what it says. They call
this
me Heat Miser.
This is the Zapruder film of song.
It really offers up a lot if you just spend lots of time with it.
Yeah, I've never seen anybody do a close reading of...
I'll finish. They call me Heat Miser. Whatever I touch starts to melt in my clutch. I'm too much. There it is, people. Now, those are the songs. The plot, very briefly... Santa Claus, played by Mickey Rooney, decides that the children of the earth do not love him sufficiently, therefore he will stay home, teaching your children a very valuable lesson about passive aggression, about withholding love as a weapon.
We just won't have Christmas then.
Exactly. Fine. That's the issue with the actual original title. Yeah. Fine then.
Fine.
Or it was Santa's Alcoholic Personality was the original title. Mrs. Claus...
The remake in the early 2000s was called Whatever.
Mrs. Claus, played by Shirley Booth. She doesn't have a first name, Mrs. Claus, because she's a woman. She is Santa's property. She decides that she is going to take Christmas into her own hands and put on the suit, because if Tim Allen has taught us nothing else, he has taught us that the Santa Claus position is really a kind of a Johnny Bravo position. You fit the suit.
Right.
So she decides she's going to put it on. She sings... anyone can be Santa. I've fantasized it a lot.
I'll bet she did.
I bet she has.
I'll bet she has.
Been a little peek
little
into, into the Claus's bedroom play.
Oh, no.
The safe word is pfeffernuss. So she decides that she's going to wear the suit and distribute it because she has access, let's remember, to the means of distribution. She has the sled. She has the reindeer. She has the bag. She's got everything she needs. But then she ultimately decides, no, that would be silly. That's really the end of it. There's a song midway through that Santa sings, Mickey Rooney sings, that goes at one point, I believe in Santa Claus like I believe in love. Which...
Wow.
Penalty, sucking, 10 yards. Awful.
See how valuable it is to
with
have
the football reps.
See how valuable it is to have football metaphors.
I
at
do
disposal.
One a decade. Oh, that was it. So anyway, that's my favorite one.
It's your favorite one.
It's a favorite one. It has flaws, but man, those tunes are are great.
To everyone who doubts that I also love this, I have on my desk Heat Miser and Snow Miser bobbleheads.
And how many people have come up to you and said, hey, Cold Miser?
I thought it was Cold Miser.
Fortunately, they are labeled Heat Miser and Snow Miser, so I get a little bit less. What I do get a surprisingly amount of is, who are those guys? Hmm. And I always want to say, oh, you poor...
These kids today.
You poor
interns.
Thing. Interns. Right. All right, how about you, Trey Graham? What's your favorite?
Well, my favorite holiday thing is also a tune. There's no, you know, a whole, you know, diatribe attached to it, but but
you can work on it.
Okay. And it's one of the very few times where you're going to hear me say that I like a studio recording of a particular thing better than the original cast album recording or the movie musical track. This, as Linda Holmes, I think, has guessed already, is the studio version of Dolly Parton singing Hard Candy Christmas from Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. And I'm just really, really fond of that song.
Hey, maybe I'll sleep real late. Maybe I'll lose some weight. Maybe I'll clear my junk. Maybe I'll just get drunk on apple wine. Me, I'll be just fine.
And what can you tell us about this song?
If I remember correctly, they are singing it because the whole house has been shut down.
Oh, I see.
And they are all, you know, busting up and moving on to other things.
Oh,
it
I
looks
see.
Like that's going to happen, right?
I see.
And I believe it is a song of comfort sung by the Madam Miss Mona.
Right.
To her girls.
For Christmas.
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
That's your,
that
your
is my
heartwarming
favorite.
Holiday memory.
You have to hear Dolly Parton sing this song.
It's from Ho House.
Yeah.
All right. My holiday memory is... my family growing up tried to create as many sort of ritualized warm Christmas memories as possible, and these ranged from every Christmas morning each child would receive a bed present. This is if you have an habitually sort of scheming child who wants to get up to open mm-hmm. Christmas presents at 3:30 in the morning, you leave a bed present so that the kid wakes up and has a present in bed and then is not compelled to go downstairs and ruin everything.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, everything from that to a certain kind of sort of holiday punch that my dad would prepare involving sherbet and whatnot. But where pop culture is most woven into these rituals is that every Christmas morning, my sister Valerie and I would wake up and crawl into my parents' bed. My father would have mysteriously been in another location doing God knows what, presumably helping Santa Claus
right.
prepare,
right.
you know, prepare the holiday trimmings.
Right.
But my sister and I would get on either side of our mother, and my mother would read us comic books. The comic books in particular that were always a part of our lives were by Carl Barks.
Mm-hmm.
Who was the man behind the Donald Duck and Uncle Scrooge and Walt Disney comics and stories, and comic books by Walt Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them were absolutely treasured figures and remain incredibly treasured mm-hmm. figures in all the respective Thompson households. And I actually emailed my mom this afternoon asking her for the names of some of these comics so that if people wanted to track them down. The Walt Kelly stuff is mostly in the public domain
mm-hmm.
and can be sought out through various reprints. The Carl Barks stuff is still in reprint.
Yeah.
So
it's Disney. They're not going to let that go.
It's Disney. Disney, for some reason, did not let all that stuff go into the public domain. I wonder how. But, of course, sending an email to my mother saying, hey, what were the names of those comic books, led me to receive about 11 emails during the course of the day. But what she particularly recommends, and I have here a list... Oh, my God, this is so long. I didn't even look at this until just now.
It's like 3 pages.
It is.
So many things. A Christmas for Shacktown, which is a heartwarming Donald Duck mm-hmm. favorite. The Golden Christmas Tree, which mm-hmm. is another Donald Duck favorite. And the Walt Kelly Christmas with Mother Goose, which
okay.
is just full of incredibly sweet and heartwarming holiday favorites.
Very nice.
It's a wonder that I grew up to become the miserable, twisted wreck that I am.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, I am going to take the opportunity to stick up for something treated as a holiday classic, but often I feel misunderstood. This is the time of year when they show It's a Wonderful Life. despite the fact that it is not actually much of a Christmas movie, and it is actually only tangentially related to Christmas. And what the point I want to make about this movie is, despite its reputation for being treacly in the area of Christmas, it is actually, for me, a fairly dark and compelling story that is not wrapped up in its gimmick about seeing the world without you. But for most of it, is a very sad story about the fact that people who make a lot of sacrifices, even if they seem saintly and angelic, are often actually very angry about the sacrifices that are required of them for the sake of other people, and that sacrificing to help others does not always mean that you do so cheerfully or that you do not suffer over those choices and having to make those choices. I think one of the smartest things that they do in explaining all of this about George Bailey and explaining this about his life is to very carefully set up that he has this very lovely romance with Donna Reed, who plays the woman who becomes his wife. And my favorite scene in the movie has nothing to do with Christmas and nothing to do with treacle, but it has to do with their initial flirtations and romance, and takes place when they're coming home from the dance after they fall in the pool. And so she's wearing a robe. And she does indeed, in an incredibly unlikely string of events, she, you know, the robe gets stepped on, and she loses the robe and winds up hiding in the bush, and this little scene ensues.
Wait a minute. What am I doing? This is a very interesting situation.
Please give me my robe.
Man doesn't get in a situation like this every day.
I'd like to have my robe.
Not in Bedford Falls, anyway.
Ouch! Oh!
Gesundheit.
George,
it requires a little thought here.
Give me my robe.
I've read about things like this, but I never...
Shame on you. I'm going to tell your mother on you.
Well, my mother's way up in the corner there.
I'll call the police.
And they're way downtown. They'd be on my side, too.
Then I'm going to scream.
Maybe I could sell tickets. No.
What I love about that scene, first of all, his line reading of "this is a very interesting situation" is one of my favorite line readings in the history of movies. It is so funny. And Jimmy Stewart in this movie is so funny in so many places, and it's part of the movie that's really lost, I think.
Yeah.
Is that scene is really, really funny. And when he has that moment when he starts to tease her, when he starts to say those little things about the police would be on my side, absolutely love that scene. And I think that's what makes the scenes later when he wants to give her things and he can't because, you know, there are sacrifices to make for the town and the family. That's what makes them work, and that's what makes them powerful. And even though everybody only thinks about the angel and the nightgown and the see what the world would be like if you had never lived, a lot of the movie is really this guy's sad story of having to make decisions that are often difficult, and that not everybody who, you know, making a warm decision to help others does not always come without actual sadness and actual frustration. And sometimes he's a guy who gets very angry, and I like that about that movie.
No, I don't care for it.
Well, that's fine. I many people don't care.
No, I love that movie. I'm funning with it.
Yeah, the people who don't care for it are the ones who have never actually seen it. They're kind of reacting to the last 15 minutes of it. That's what they're reacting to.
I think that's right.
Well, and as we've discussed on this show, there's a certain elitism that comes with anytime something is sort of universally regarded as something that everyone loves, then naturally it must be terrible.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
But that is a fantastic movie.
And it contains lots of joy, and I do enjoy the joy.
And in spite of that, I still really, really love
it. Exactly. I like joy during the holiday season. Okay, Glenn Weldon, what is your least favorite?
This is going to be quick. It's the 2006 live-action version of The Year Without a Santa Claus, which starred Michael McKean as Snow Miser and Harvey Firestein as Heat Miser.
How could that
go wrong?
Wow.
It went wrong by just losing all the charm and whimsy and just really hitting the pathos, sappy, sentimental stuff really, really hard. ABC Family, thank you very much. Going all out with the thing they did. So it was...
I forgot all about that.
You know, he has fire in his name. What more? Well, it's right there. It's,
well, he does say, I'm too much.
He does say that.
It's also fitting.
He's not wrong.
It is one is tempted to make jokes about flaming.
Exactly. So it is an abomination, and let us not speak of it again.
Excellent. How about you, Trey Graham? What's your favorite abomination?
RuPaul's cover of Hard Candy Christmas.
There you go. Look how we're...
Every holiday season, it comes back to torment me.
Yep.
I can't get away from RuPaul's cover.
I go to Target and RuPaul's...
There it is.
All right. I kind of want to live in a world where that's Candy Christmas. He's playing in every Target.
Don't you feel like on balance it would make the world a better place if that happened?
Don't be jealous of his boogie.
I'm eternally jealous of his boogie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, how about you, Thompson? What's your least favorite for Christmas?
Why should we?
Is there a comic book that you really hate?
Yeah, why should we dwell?
Yeah, I'm about to tell you why I actually hate Jimmy Stewart.
Why should we dwell on the negative this holiday season? I mean, everybody knows there are endlessly crass commercial concerns, and there are terrible holiday specials, and there are clearly just the very existence of a Jim Carrey live-action version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas is mm-hmm. just unbelievably appalling. And to be honest, and in the interest of full disclosure, I have never actually seen the live-action version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas, but I've seen enough.
It certainly seems like a bad idea.
Absolutely yeah. insufferable commercials wherein he's wisecracking, mm-hmm. which is just so, so terribly wrong. I mean, I really start trotting out How the Grinch Stole Christmas on DVD long about October 15th. So my love of
you
that.
You are now my least favorite thing about the holiday season, because that is wrong.
On the other hand, I would like to point out Christine Baranski as the decorating obsessed neighbor lady, right? I think in the live action version.
It's been a long time. Neighbor lady. What?
There is no neighbor lady. That's wrong. I thought you were going to say she played the dog.
I was going to say, unless a branch was tied to her forehead, then I disapprove.
Well, that's the thing about the cartoon. You know, the thing I respond to most strongly is Max. Max is really a function of Chuck Jones' talents, and he's not really, I mean, he's in the book, he's sort of a Dr. Seuss creation, but all that Max stuff is pure mm-hmm. Chuck Jones.
I will admit, although you said the thing about October, and I quite rightly condemned you for that, I did read The Grinch this fall.
Oh, really? To
a couple of my friends' kids, because that was what they wanted to hear.
So you did, huh?
Well, it wasn't my choice.
Interestingly, what do I have in my house?
What do you have in your house?
Kids.
You have kids, that's true.
Uh-huh.
All right, I give up. Here's my least favorite thing about the holiday, and there's a little bit of a story here. I have a sister who is very entertaining, who I enjoy very much. And
I like where this is going already.
And we have frequently spent a lot of time just sitting around watching TV during the holiday season. And long about 1990, after Home Alone had come out, there was, when they were putting Home Alone on TV, there was a commercial for the TV showings of Home Alone that we kept seeing on TV.
Dashing for the plane, trying to make the flight.
Come on!
Mom and Dad just made
Kevin!
A tiny oversight.
Ah!
As they hurry home, two robbers plan a heist. Little do they know, he's got his home turf iced. Home Alone, Home Alone, he tricked them every way. All the fun it is to see two burglars get far away.
For those of you not following on the video podcast, Linda Holmes is silently singing along and waving her hands in the
chair
air.
Dancing.
Okay, so actually, now that I think of it, I think those were actually ads for the movie, now that I think about it. I don't think
really?
It was TV showings. I think it was for the movie. Huh. So the great thing about this is that my sister and I immediately fastened on both the horrible Home Alone refrain, as well as the line, oh, what fun it is to see two burglars get flambéed. And we, for years at Christmas time, you could just say, Home Alone, Home Alone. And so in the broader sense,
yes,
my least favorite thing about the holiday is that you do get these endless parodies of carols with various different words attached to them. Mm-hmm. I think you will find, if you search your memory, that some of these are earwormed into your brain as well, along with now, Home Alone.
Thanks, Linda.
Thanks a lot.
I think one thing I'm enormously grateful for this holiday season is that elections, I think this is why elections are held like really early in November, mm-hmm. so you don't get parodied Christmas carols in campaign ads.
Holy.
Can you imagine how much worse election season would be if it coincided with Christmas?
Obama, all you faithful.
I'm going to cut that off right now.
Yes.
I'm going to stop it here.
Have John McCain as Snow Miser.
I mean, I just feel that various companies and commercial concerns and other things put together their little parody carols with their own words, and I think that has to end in favor of better Christmas commercials such as... Now, that is the best one. As you probably know, that is the Handbell Hershey Kisses. And that is the classic, to me, Christmas commercial, maybe with the exception of the kid running downstairs when the brother comes home in the Folgers commercial and she runs downstairs in her pajamas and says, Peter! And then because Peter's yeah. home. And it's between those two. But definitely, if everybody would go with the Hershey Kisses Handbell instrumental as opposed to writing your own words,
sure.
such as Home Alone, Home Alone. We would all
keep
be much
doing
better.
This. Yes,
less is more. I think okay. we can agree that the principle that works for that is less is more. None is better.
We would
is more.
None is better than less.
So that's what I do not like. Now that we have all given you our pop culture highs and lows of the holiday season, feel free to come by the blog npr.org/monkeysee and add your holiday pop culture highs and lows. And of course, that will add to the discussion and hopefully everyone will start fighting. It'll be just like every Christmas.
Turkey, no ham. Turkey, no ham.
Turkey. So we have a time for a quick round of what's making you happy this week. Glenn Wilden, what's making you happy this week?
You know, those of us who read and or write comics have a sense of humor about our genre. We have a sense of humor. We had to defend it to so many people for so long. We've had it sneered at for so long. We have a sort of defense mechanism. We embrace the goofy parts of it. People who love and write genre fiction, your romance, your mysteries, your mm-hmm. sci-fi, your fantasy. They also share this phenomenon of embracing the thing that they love and having a healthy, I would call it a healthy sense of humor about it. The makers and lovers of literary fiction, however, among this group, that behavior trait is not exactly thick on the ground. I'm just going to mm-hmm. come out and say that. And I say as one who spent some significant part of my life in the bowels and the salt mines of literary fiction, and egregious, insufferable pretension is the default. Let's just say that way.
That is thick on the ground.
That is thick on the ground. And when you find somebody who has a sense of humor about themselves in that world, you remember it and you embrace it, which is why when I came across on the Washington Post website the totally hip video book reviews, it was a revelation. These are done by Ron Charles, who is the Washington Post fiction critic, or one of them. And these are 4 to 5 minute little videos in which he assumes the persona of an insufferably pretentious book critic from a major metropolitan paper. And he talks about various books. And these things are done on the ultra cheap in his house. He sometimes drags his hapless wife into the proceedings.
How many times have you settled in all comfy and warm in your snuggie, only to realize how hard it is to read? Well, not anymore. Now there's the Bookly, the book with sleeves. Bookly is made from the pages of remaindered novels by the most popular authors, so you can catch up with your favorite writers and still be wrapped in warm prose. You know how hard it is to cook, watch TV, or just relax when you're reading a book. But super large, one-size-fits-all Bookly keeps your hands free, so you can do almost anything while pretending to read. And you'll never get stuck in the bathroom without toilet paper again. America's favorite book with sleeves is available in yellow journalism, purple prose, or black comedy. Do not smoke or cook while wearing the Bookly. Do not wear near open flame. Bookly is not right for everyone. Not recommended for witches or others who make it burned.
The jokes that he's doing, some of them land, some of them don't. That's not the point. What is the point is how unselfconsciously and exultantly goofy these things are. And watching seven, as I have in recent weeks, it's so winning. It's so charming. And here's the thing it also does. It makes you want to read the book he's talking about. Mm-hmm. So go to the Washington Post book section, click on the totally hip video book reviews, and you will be delighted.
Wonderful. How about you, Trey?
Awesome sauce. Earlier in this season of Pop Culture Happy Hour, previously on Pop Culture Happy Hour. I indicated that the thing that was making me happy was the fact that society has advanced to the point where a reality show like The A-List can exist. What's making me happy now is that the first season of The A-List is over. Because, as I've discussed with Linda before, I know, I'm kind of a bitter ender. When I start to watch something, I often feel like I'm obliged to watch it, you know, just out of a sense of deranged loyalty. So I watched Heroes, for instance, much longer than I should have. Uh-huh. I watched Desperate Housewives much longer than I should have, just out of this sense of loyalty. And I did. I did, in fact, sit through all of the episodes of The A-List on Logo, which is, without a doubt, one of the least redeemable reality programs on television.
I did see on The Soup Ryken singing his little song.
Oh, my goodness.
Up to the sky. Up to the sky, up to the sky, You know I love you up to the sky. You know I love you up to the sky.
It was not good.
It was so not good. Now, what I haven't seen, what I was not able to watch today in the time that that we had to prepare for the podcast, was the reunion show hosted by Wendy Williams.
Of course.
Because it was not, because it, I didn't get to watch it.
Lighting her Slim Jims on fire, as she does.
Awesome.
Because I didn't get to watch it at home, and it was not yet available for viewing online. So what I'm going to have to do is just say that this show, to me, went off the rails about, I don't know, midway through, maybe a little bit more than halfway through, and it was as though the producers and editors and whoever is shaping the storylines on the show just decided that it didn't matter anymore. No one was interested in the characters they were playing. Uh-huh. No one was interested in making sure that those characters had a through line for the season. And regardless of what you believe about how reality shows are built and shaped and how much storylining and storyboarding goes into them, you do have to cut them together in a way that makes it seem like the people are conceivably
human.
Right. Uh-huh. And about midway through the season, this show completely lost track of that idea. Characters would change loyalties without any discernible reason. Mm. They would change perspectives without any discernible reason. It was just egregiously bad, and I'm so glad it's over.
Yeah. Woohoo!
So join us. Join us if you watch the reunion show. Please join us in the comments at Monkey C and tell us what happened, because I can't bear. Yeah. To watch
it. No, you watched the entire season.
Yeah,
I feel
you
like
to
you
stick
should,
to the
you got to stick
end.
It through.
I don't know.
We'll yeah, see. No. We'll see. I don't feel that the bitter end rule extends to reunions.
Right. I do not have the proper ironic distance for the show. This show made me very angry. Mm. I'm not usually that guy who's like, well, this is what really awful people say. Middle America is not going to understand that gay people aren't like that. Like that sort of, I'm not that guy who says that.
Yeah. Mm.
I will say that this show confirms what the worst homophobes believe about us.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It feeds into this idea that all gay men are vain, shallow, tedious, horrible people, and there's nothing redeeming. It's not funny. It's not Jack on Will and Grace. It's not it's not Carson Kressley. There's nothing clever. There's nothing fun. It is merely confirming the absolute worst of what terrible people think about us.
But let me ask you this. Is it possible, and I strictly raise this as a question, but is it possible that the reason why they felt like they could do this show is that those extreme views have become
so marginalized.
Fringy enough, marginalized enough, that now Logo feels like it's safe to do this. No, the same way that everybody kind of knows that all women are not the Real Housewives.
Sure. And that was Trey's point in the beginning, that we've evolved as a society.
Right, I remember him
saying that. It still makes me very angry.
Sure, no, I understand that.
I feel like my insides curdling with rage when I watch this show. Yeah. Because there's nothing, again, I'll go back to this. If it was funny, I would totally be in.
Yeah.
It's not funny.
See, and the interesting thing is when I see The Real Housewives, which I, for an assortment of obvious reasons, do not relate to on any level and is not depicting my world in any way, I still feel that level of frustration and anger and nausea just looking into it as if it were just a mirror reflecting humanity. And I just find it is a reflection of sort of an ugliness and grievance mining that is in a lot of people, and I find it sort of toxic that way. Not even as this makes women look bad or this makes the wealthy look bad. Not that I am either. So I just wonder if even if you weren't gay, if you watch that show, that it might be like, oh, what this says about humanity is just nauseating. I have not seen the A-List, and it sure sounds like I need to.
It's entirely possible, because I don't watch The Real Housewives either, just because it makes my soul sick. So,
and that's kind of what we're saying. Yeah. I mean, it might be that you are just the kind of person whose soul becomes sick at all soul-sickening people.
Right, and that's what I'm proposing.
And good for you, Isaac.
I don't know.
I think that to an extent that is not true for The Real Housewives. The Real Housewives does not depend for all of its success on the belief of most people that these people represent real success. The A-List, by virtue of its name to begin with, traffics in the claim that these people are in fact tremendously successful or nearly so, and that they are the pinnacle of successful New York gay people in society.
And you don't
that
get it,
could
you,
not be not, further from the truth,
being,
first of all.
They're not being mocked.
I was going to say, you don't get a sense of...
They're being mocked by the production team, obviously, of course. But again, I just don't have the... Intestinal fortitude for
the show. I don't think anyone is suggesting you should watch the A-List. No, I don't think that's the suggestion.
I agree with you. I think the kind of mocking that's being done is being done in the editing room. It's not being done
right now. Right. There are probably people out there who will look at this and hold it up as a serious example of depravity. And actually, you know, maybe they are the same show. Maybe they are both the bread and circuses that people will point to 1,000 years from now when they're chronicling the decline and fall of the American Empire. Mm-hmm. You know.
I have to say, the other thing that's interesting is that my frustration with shows like this is often that they wind up tarring the entire genre of unscripted television. Because, for instance, there's actually a really good, carefully researched series running in the Kansas City paper right now by Aaron Barnhart, who's been writing about TV forever, and who has done this sort of in-depth look at reality television. But everything sort of gets lumped together. And to me, when you get to the point where you're considering something like Top Chef, it's all part of a piece with stuff like this.
The Littlest Groom.
The more stuff like that there is, the harder it is to explain why some sort of candid, unscripted shows are actually sort of interesting more than that. Obviously, it's not as significant a complaint as the one that you're making, but...
I think an interesting comparison is, you know, the same network brings us RuPaul's Drag Race.
Mm-hmm.
And that, at least in its first season, was a delightful
show.
I embrace that.
It exploited...
So
which,
fun.
Like, everyone loves.
It exploited interpersonal conflict in a similar way. Mm-hmm. They certainly set those contestants against each other in some similar ways. But the show was... basically about celebrating talent in the way that we've talked about Top Chef and The Amazing Race celebrating talent, right?
Right.
Yep. So I guess this is my problem. The A-List celebrates nothing.
Yeah.
It celebrates making just spectacles of these sad, ignorant people.
Well, and it has seemed to me at least like the people are at least interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, they're train wrecky at certain moments, but they're not just train wrecky.
They're self-aware. They kind of have to be. They're self-conscious. They're also self-aware. But funny. Funny trumps everything.
Yeah.
It comes down to
that's really true.
And it's a funny show.
Yeah.
And yes, I have said my piece.
Fantastic. How about you, Stephen? What's making you happy this week?
Well, one thing making me happy this week is that I just received an email from my mother. This would be email number 11D6 with a gigantic...
It's like she's listening.
It is, with a gigantic PDF of How Santa Got His Red Suit.
Aww.
Which is a delightful comic book that is immediately flooding back to me right as we speak. As you guys are talking about the A-List, I'm going, How Santa Got His Red Suit. So if I may read the first paragraph for you, as if you were all my children at home. I'm sorry, I had to take that back. Many, many centuries ago, Santa Claus was just as kindly and generous as he is today, but... there was one big difference. He didn't wear a red suit. He wore yellow cloaks or purple-black waistcoats or white-green trousers sometimes, other times blue. In fact, he wore whatever suited his fancy. Santa was very proud of his many gay costumes.
Brings it back to RuPaul right there.
Oh, what a kicker, Thompson. Well done.
Little did we know.
Well done.
What is also making me happy, speaking of reality television, is Top Chef All-Stars, which is great.
Agreed.
Yes,
agreed.
Totally agree.
When you talk about the fact that, the presumed fact, I have not actually seen it, that the A-List ultimately becomes very indifferently edited to the point where they stop bothering to stitch together narratives with their characters, it's a reminder that editing reality television, if it's done really well, is a very, very difficult craft, not unlike editing any other television.
Mm-hmm.
And
storytellers. They function a lot like writers in some ways.
And a lot of reality shows, of course, do have writers, I think, in part to sculpt, to sort of craft these narratives out of, you know, an enormous number of things that happen over the course of several weeks and many, many, many cameras. And Top Chef All-Stars they've only aired as of this taping one episode, and they just immediately get so many things right, starting with the addition of Anthony Bourdain. And I know that Anthony Bourdain has his detractors. I am not among them.
No way.
I really, really like
have you read that guy's books? If you ever decide you want to read another book,
that's a good place to start.
You should read some Anthony Bourdain, because I think you would really
Kitchen
enjoy
Confidential.
His books. Yeah.
I'm not so crazy about the medium of books, but I may try, that. I just love Anthony Bourdain, and having him in there, just having a cast of, you know, partly as another season of Hell's Kitchen groans on with a bunch of incompetent line cooks, seeing, you know, a bunch of people you've seen before, you know, with, you know, the sort of requisite D-bags being brought back to immediately announce that they have learned nothing. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that just one by one, all of the token D-bags have their confessionals in which they explain that they have learned nothing. And that the lesson that they felt that they learned from their season is how awesome they are.
Yeah, sure.
But just so many likable people. And you know, the first task was really clever. And I'm just immediately...
Really good job of casting that
immediately
season.
Back in that show's good graces after what I thought was a very, very disappointing DC season.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. I think the first episode was very, very promising, and I'm excited about it. And speaking of first episodes, I will not spend too much time on this because I spoke about it on the blog today, but my thing making me happy this week, as we all probably know, is the Sing-Off. I love the Sing-Off. The Sing-Off is back on NBC. This is the a cappella competition that they ran last year, which mostly served to highlight the spectacular greatness of Ben Folds as a reality judge, who, seriously, if you like nothing else about this show, he is the best reality show judge I have ever seen on any show. He is extremely polite, but he is also very blunt. He is straightforward and easy to understand, and he is very specific about criticism. You know, you so often get judges on singing shows or performance shows who are going for the most colorful thing they can possibly say.
Right.
And that's where you get these Simon Cowell, you know, you're like an Argentinian wedding on a cruise ship with Mickey Mouse and those kinds of things.
Well, I mean, Bourdain does that.
Yes, Bourdain does that, and he's great at it. And there's nothing wrong with that kind of judge. But what Ben Folds does with these groups, obviously being a musician himself, I'm sure helps, but he will start off and he will say, okay, the bass line started off a little bit sharp. And then from there, I think everybody else gradually sort of went sharp because the basses were sharp.
When it's as entertaining as you guys made it, it almost alleviates some of the musical things that are going on, which you were a little pitchy. And I think it started in the basses, honestly, and then it worked its way up. That's totally fine on this performance because I don't think it bothered anyone here. Because, as you said, you want to be more than just another group of 15 dudes that are imitating women. So, and I think you're going to be great. I've got high hopes for you. I think it's going
to
be really good.
And he will be able to pick that kind of thing out, and he'll be able to speak very knowledgeably about what really happened, what was happening with the percussive stuff, what was happening with the different parts. And honestly, to me, it is the pinnacle of reality show judging. And it's only on, it was only on for a couple weeks last year. It's only going to be on for a couple few weeks this year, leading up to Christmas. But NBC, The Sing-Off, really, really good. And you got to watch it to see how incredibly great Ben Folds is as a judge.
Can I jump in here with a bonus round, what's making me happy?
Yes.
No.
I just got a note from Brian Reed, a former Croc Fellow here at NPR. And and I believe currently doing something else for us in some exotic place, who tells me that the music director of the Whiff and Poofs is currently looking for Linda Holmes, wanting to give her some feedback about how she took them to the woodshed today on Monkey See.
I explained that what the Whiff and Poofs do is kind of knowing, and that it is not something where they are clueless about what they have, what they do, or anything like that. They just are punchable, and they know that they're punchable. If you have never seen the Yale Whiff and Poofs, they are a male a cappella group. They all wear white tie and tails and gloves, and for real, they are really punchable.
And if you visit the blog, just the video still that greets you when you take a look.
Yes, this is true.
Every one of those faces, eminently punchable.
I will say that by angering the Whiff and Poofs, you are necessitating the least effectual security detail.
The anti-Whiff and Poofs. Oh, who, as I pointed out in the blog today, they call themselves the Whiffs, which they sort of have to. I will say, I think the Whiff and Poofs are musically very good. They just are, they're way too whiff and poofy. But anyway, I love you, Whiff and Poofs. I come from that tradition. It's all, we all love, you know, you just are the villains. That's the way it is. You got to embrace your
role.
Have,
you have been cast as the villains on this particular reality show, is what Linda means.
You are the, you're the bad guy.
Not like in the culture at large.
You're the Russell. You're the, you know, you're the whoever.
Little Richard.
You're the Team Guido. It's okay. Anyway, so that's what's making me happy this week.
You're the biggest dork ever. That's why I love you, Holmesy.
That's what's making me happy this week. I love the sing-off, and I'm sorry I offended the women. Anyway, so that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey Graham at Trey Graham, which Stephen likes to sing as
Trey with an E, then Graham like the cracker.
I wanted sleigh bells.
I would like that to be critiqued.
What I would like is to have that done by the Whiff and Poofs.
Yes, please. Please.
You can follow Glenn Weldon at G.H. Weldon. That's W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our awesome producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music you're probably enjoying right now. And thanks to all of you guys for being here, as always.
Thanks, happy Linda. Holidays.
Always a pleasure.
And happy holidays.
Not that this is our last show before the holidays, but it's kind of our holiday-themed show.
It is. And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.